Good afternoon and welcome to The Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, when might gas prices come back down? Some experts say never. We'll explore the realities of fuel prices. Then, from broken heart to suicide bomber, we'll explore the various drives that fuel deadly terror. Finally, on the Scholar Circle, what the Putin election and the rising widespread protests mean for Russia and the world. Republican presidential candidates are using high gas prices to criticize President Obama. But our next guest says high gas prices are here to stay. The only way toward affordable energy, he says, is through developing alternative fuels. If Americans are increasingly conserving gas, what is driving high prices? And can the U.S. move to cleaner alternative energy sources? Tyson Slocum joins us. He's the director of Public Citizens Energy Program. Can you explain to us what is keeping gas prices high?
Generally, what's keeping gas prices high is the fact that it's a finite commodity. There's only so much oil trapped underneath the earth. So in the world, continues to use a lot of it. The easy conventional ways to get oil are drying up, which leaves us much more expensive and environmentally harmful unconventional oil, whether that's deep water in the Gulf of Mexico, whether it's the tar sands in Alberta, Canada, whether it's oil sands or oil shale in North Dakota. So all of this is driving prices up, but there's no question that a bad situation is being made worse by speculators who are driving prices probably at least 50 cents or so a gallon higher than they otherwise would be if we didn't have speculators driving 85% of the trading market where the prices of oil and gasoline and other energy products are set. So the bottom line is our entire energy infrastructure was designed to accommodate essentially a dollar a gallon gas. And it worked great when gasoline was a dollar and when we didn't worry about environmental problems or the externality. But those days are over. We're not going to get to $2 or $2.50 a gallon gas. I don't care how much often Newt Gingrich promises it. But the fact is that the era of more expensive fossil fuels is upon us. We should do all we can to make sure that those expensive fuels are priced as fairly as possible by reining in the speculators. But the bottom line is the only way we're going to return to really lower priced energy is to move towards the renewable energy. That is the long-term cheap energy resource that the United States has been abandoning at our own peril. We have to focus on the cheap energy of the future, which is renewable, and understand that gasoline will never be cheap again.
Can you give us the politics of renewables? We know that there's a big oil and gas lobby, but there's also now kind of a growing renewable lobby. What is the relationship there that is preventing the alternative from developing?
The relationship is that the renewable lobby is absolutely overwhelmed, outspent, and outmatched by the fossil fuel industry. You have to remember, the United States is the largest fossil fuel producing nation in the world. When you add up all of our oil and natural gas and coal production, we're number one, okay? We're the Saudi Arabia of fossil fuel production. And what that translates into is a very, very financially and politically powerful fossil fuel industry, you know, led by big oil like Exxon. We also have big natural gas companies like Chesapeake. We've got big coal companies like Arch and Peabody. And they outspend and outlobby and outmaneuver the renewable folks because they're defending their turf. The last thing that ExxonMobil wants to see is a real alternative to our fossil fuel addiction. Okay? They make a fortune selling us gas and oil. But what Americans need is to break free from our fossil fuel dependence and liberate our economy by moving towards renewable energy. But at this point, the fossil fuel producers dominate the debate in Washington, which is why you continue to hear this mantra of drill, baby, drill. It's asinine. There's no factual documentation that states that we can drill our way to cheaper oil or gasoline prices. It is impossible. We will never do it. And the more the politicians take their talking points from the fossil fuel lobbyists spinning this lie, the longer it's going to take for us to replace the fossil fuels with the renewable energy revolution that America needs to have.
talk to us about the subsidies that go to each of these industries, because one of the things that I think people are aware of is that it's going to be really difficult to get an alternative green energy industry moving without some government support. But the truth is that the government is supporting and subsidizing the other industries. Can you break this down for us?
Oh, the subsidies are at least 10 to 1 in favor of fossil fuels, and that's a conservative estimate. You are absolutely right that the oil companies receive huge tax and royalty breaks that are, on average, around $10 billion or so a year. And that far outweighs whatever subsidies the renewable and energy efficiency industries are receiving. Same goes for large subsidies for coal, for nuclear power, for natural gas. And then you also have a number of exemptions from federal oversight, whether it's exemptions for the natural gas industry from having to comply with the Federal Clean Water and Federal Clean Drinking Water Act. But the fact is that we are going to need to provide some assistance to renewables to get them a foothold into the marketplace, much like what we saw with what Germany did. Germany spends $30 billion a year on demand-side incentives for rooftop solar, something called a feed-in tariff, where the rate is where the subsidy is built into electric rate rather than tax-based. And that subsidy has launched Germany to the largest manufacturer of solar components, and they've got 630% more installed solar capacity than the United States.
Germany just announced it's cutting its subsidies.
That's right. They're cutting it because they've been so successful. Because if Americans want to buy a solar array for their rooftop, it's going to be manufactured in either Germany or China, not in the United States. And that's because Germany dedicated big subsidies to grow a domestic market so that when you go around Germany, you see rooftop solar. And Germany has no business beating us 630% in installed solar capacity, right? We're the Saudi Arabia of sun. We've got huge solar capacity that's not being realized because the incumbent utility and fossil fuel companies, the last thing they want is a solar rooftop revolution where customers, households, are manufacturing their own clean, renewable energy from the sun. If you're an energy company, that's a nightmare.
Unless they ended up investing within these alternative companies, which would be an interesting development. Let me just switch for a second to talk about the current administration, because the Obama administration in the last stimulus bill had put reasonable support for development of a green industry and the development of alternative fuels and alternative energy that were more environmentally friendly. Where do you see the administration going now?
The administration does have to be applauded for trying to put a lot of financial backing into the renewable sector. I think the problem was is they had the wrong type of subsidy. They had this loan guarantee program, which is attractive for politicians because it's a loan guarantee. So it features very inexpensive upfront costs to the taxpayer. The only real cost occurs is if there's a loan default, which is what we're now experiencing with Solyndra and another renewable energy company. So now taxpayers, you know, are on the hook for $500 million for that loan guarantee. But I think that the administration needs to take the German model and understand you cannot incentivize the transition on the cheap. You've got to go all in, and you've got to do it from the demand side, right? We're a demand consumption-based economy where that's where the markets are. And I think that if you incentivize demand for people to install rooftop solar, then the manufacturers are going to capture a growing domestic market share. That's how you grow the manufacturing sector. That said, the administration, I think, can do more, but they've done a lot more than previous administrations. And he's getting attacked for it. That the Republicans are trying to play in this election is that Obama is only focused on giving away ineffective incentives to his cronies in the solar industry, and that's just a lie. The fact is that the only thing that is going to deliver lower prices and energy independence in the future is going to be establishment of a robust renewable energy sector in the United States.
Do you see that occurring in either the form of another stimulus or something like that?
I think it's going to be very difficult because there is a culture in D.C. that is now very focused on cutting government programs and slashing spending. So the availability of federal funds when it's most needed is not there. So I see that we have a very contentious political environment in Washington, D.C., and I just don't see ample cooperation on dedicating the funding needed to make this renewable energy transition.
Tyson Slocum, I know you have to catch an airplane. Thank you for being with us. I'd like to follow up with you as these things develop. Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure.
You are listening to The Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. What causes the kind of radical militancy behind suicide bombings and other deadly violence on civilians? It's a question that many social scientists have studied. But our next guest, a former federal prosecutor, decided to find out his own way by asking them directly. Ken Ballin interviewed scores of so-called terrorists and found their reason for killing surprising. His book, Terrorists in Love, profiles six of their stories. Welcome, Ken Ballin.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you, Maria.
It's great to have you with us. I think before we talk about the substantive interviews in your book, I wanted to inquire about your realizations in your prosecutorial life. You talked about some of your experiences in interrogation, terrorists, killers, child molesters, and you said you had to put yourself in their shoes. What can you tell us about this dynamic?
You have to be able to communicate with them. By putting yourself in their shoes, it's not that you ever approve of what they've done or that you're ever really empathizing with them. You keep your distance from them in a certain way, but you also have to not pass judgment so that you're able to elicit from them their confessions. And then part of your job as a prosecutor and as an interrogator, and this was certainly true with the terrorists that I interviewed for this book, was to corroborate as much as possible everything these people told you. So it's not a matter of sitting down there and just listening to them. It's a matter of having the skills of an experienced interrogator. I've done this for some two decades, and then being able to corroborate it.
You actually used the word empathy. Did you really have empathy? Empathy and developing a human bond with your nemeses.
Yes, with some of them I was able to connect because they're still human beings. Whatever horrendous actions they've taken, they're still human beings. And it's important to connect with that part of them in order that they feel comfortable confessing and divulging their true stories.
Once you develop a human bond, is it difficult then to prosecute?
No, because that's your job.
You said that in one case you got a son to wire his father. How do you get a son to wire his father for you?
This is not as unusual as it seems. This is part of your job as a prosecutor and investigator. You develop confidence in people, and sometimes you're able to give them some benefits for cooperating with you.
And then the other thing that I was struck by was how you were talking about torture and how it really does not produce any truth.
I can tell you that my experience as a prosecutor and as an investigator and interrogator and the experience of the FBI, torture is never used. I mean, torture, oftentimes what happens with torture is you get false information because people want to stop the torture and will say anything so that you stop the torture and actually are more inclined to tell you what you want to hear. There's the famous case, of course, of the terrorist who was sent to Egypt by the United States, tortured, and then said that there was weapons of mass destruction and cooperation between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. And he later said, well, I said all of that to stop the torture because I knew that's what the Americans wanted me to say. So that's the danger in torture. You get information, but it's not necessarily reliable information. And so therefore you go down a false path oftentimes with torture.
I wonder if sometimes prosecution may be so frustrated or so overzealous that they're sort of desperate for any direction and that torture emerges from that. Do you think that that ever does happen?
No, I don't. What happened after 9/11 was that the interrogation program was turned over to people who did not have experience in interrogations, believe it or not, who came up with this whole regime of torture. It was not left in the hands of the professionals. Like, for example, the FBI strenuously opposed use of torture at Guantanamo and elsewhere, and this whole program was taken away from them. So it left the hands of the professionals and went into the hands of amateurs, and that's what you get.
Right.
So I don't think it has anything to do with people being frustrated. I think it has to do with the fact that after 9/11, people who are professional at this were not given charge of the program.
You went and interviewed several people who attempted to, in many cases, blow themselves up while fighting in a holy jihad. And one of the places that you went in Saudi Arabia was this prison that was a rehabilitation prison. I'm going to ask you to get into some of the interviews there, but what can you tell us about this, its setup, its intent, and who you met with there?
Well, I interviewed several hundred people who were radicals. Terrorists. About half of them did not open up to me because they would give me what rhetoric. It was like listening to an Osama bin Laden speech. I would say about a little over 100 or so I actually interviewed at length. And of those 100 that I interviewed, six individuals' stories were so compelling, changed everything I thought I knew as an expert, so-called expert in this area, that I felt I had to share those stories in this book, which is called Terrorists in Love, The Real Lives of Islamic Radicals. And those six stories comprise the core of the book. And it's not an analytical book. It's a book telling the life stories, the true life stories of these individuals, their ancestry, their grandfather, their grandmother, their parents, how they became radicalized, what their culture was like, what led them to the radical cause. And for many of these individuals, and as importantly, what led them away. So this was a product of 6 years of work and interviewing literally hundreds of people. And I hadn't set out to write a book. I was in these countries overseas conducting research into public opinion and trying to figure out why people supported extremism. And as part of that research, would talk to radicals. And then these six individuals, their stories were so compelling and, as I said, changed everything I thought I knew that I felt I had to share them.
The first one that you talked about was this young man, Ahmed. He was in this Saudi rehabilitation prison, which I think what was most striking was how much pain he had in his life prior to becoming radicalized.
Well, he did. And, you know, many of the individuals do. And I think that's something to keep in mind. I mean, they join the cause not simply from ideological commitment or religious fervor, but they also join from personal circumstances. Ahmad couldn't find work. He was a young man in Saudi Arabia. He was estranged from his father, which is a difficult situation in a very traditional patriarchal society. He went to Iraq. He went to Iraq because, in part, though, he saw the pictures at Abu Ghraib of, if you recall, the American Army prison where people were tortured. So he went to fight. He was a very idealistic young man. He thought he was doing the right thing, protecting his Muslim brothers. He, in fact, when he arrived in Iraq with 25 other young men from all over the Arab world, the Al-Qaeda leader exhorted them to suicide attacks because telling them this is the most noble mission you could do. But nobody volunteered for that. As Ahmad told me, you know, I went there to fight for my Muslim brothers, and yes, I knew if I was killed, I'd go to heaven, but I was in no hurry to get there, and I wanted to do some good on earth first. Anyway, what happened is when he went to Iraq, he was kept in for 4 months, basically in isolation, not trained on any weapon, kept in boredom, allowed to pray, but do very little else. And he was desperate to do anything. Finally, he went on a mission with some other Iraqi jihadis, and he was driving a tanker truck. And about 1,000 yards before a concrete barrier, the Iraqi jihadis jump out of the tanker truck. He has to drive it because otherwise it would go out of control. And within literally less than 20 seconds, the truck is remotely detonated. It contained 26 tons of liquid explosives. It killed killed 8 people on the spot and countless scores were injured, including Ahmad, who miraculously survived but had serious burns throughout his body, lost most of his fingers and toes, his face was completely disfigured. And then he was taken to Abu Ghraib, of all places. He was petrified because this is what caused him to go, this in part. So he was petrified, what's going to happen to me? Instead, he was given 30 operations by the American doctors, skin transplants, cellulite infusions. He was patiently and carefully nursed back to health, talked how to walk again, how to talk again. Most of all, he met an American Army medic who was tremendous with him, and it was the first woman he had ever met outside his own family, which is extraordinary for us. You know, he became fiercely pro-American in his heart as a result of this experience. He said to me, my Muslim brothers who I went to fight for treated me like a piece of rotten meat. The Americans who I went to fight against treated me with kindness and respect.
what had led him down the path in the first place sounded like he really felt bad about himself. He had an abusive father. He didn't have a lot of friends, and he felt he had sinned, and he wanted to sort of redeem himself.
Well, that's part of it. I mean, part of it was he just, you know, many people join a cause, young people join a cause because they want to feel a greater meaning in their lives. And then when he got there, he saw that that the greater meaning was not what he thought it was. And this is a common experience among many of them, and many of them are manipulated by their leaders into committing suicide attacks and are lied to, and while their leaders are busy stealing money, and they use these young men as cannon fodder. In this sense, Ahmad's story is not unique.
Another one that really stood out for me was the one you called the jihadi Romeo and Juliet, Abby and Miriam, who are in love but can't be together. And they are both suicidal, really, for personal reasons. Tell us about these two and what leads them down the radical path.
They're like very much like a Romeo and Juliet. They fall madly in love as teenagers and even serenade each other from open windows, as the Shakespearean couple once did. But this is not Shakespeare, and in Saudi Arabia, the young man Abdullah needed a dowry or bride price to marry his love. He didn't have the money. He had $8,000. The going bride price was $20,000. So Miriam's father marries her off against her will to a man three times her age. So he's in his 60s as a fourth wife. He's got $30,000, so he can marry her. She actually rebels against this, at least symbolically commits suicide. Abdullah thinks he should commit suicide, but he knows that that's a great sin, so he thinks that he should go and fight in holy war, because if he dies in holy war, then he goes to heaven, and in heaven, he can marry whomever he wants to, including the love of his life, Miriam. So it's a kind of a tragic story, again, like Romeo and Juliet. This is not Shakespeare. It's real life, and real life in Saudi Arabia in the 20th and 21st century.
You noted that a number of your interviewees eventually saw that Al-Qaeda was really leading vulnerable people into a path of violence and hate. But it was not across the board that people saw that.
And it's also the Taliban. Half the people portrayed of the six were involved with Al-Qaeda. The other half were involved with the Taliban in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And, you know, some saw the light, but one interview I did was of a man by the name of Malik. Malik rose to quite a privileged position inside the Taliban. He would interpret dreams for the leader of the Taliban, Mullah Omar, and Mullah Omar would decide battle strategy, believe it or not, on the basis of these dreams and visions that he and this fellow Malik had. Anyway, though, Malik in time saw the corruption of the Taliban, the theft of oil, the manipulation and the lies of the leaders. So he became disillusioned with the Taliban, and I was in the interview with him, and thinking to myself, wow, this is another guy like Ahmad who goes through this experience and sees the corruption and goes away. And he reaches out towards the end of the interview, we've been talking for quite a long time, and to hold my hand in friendship, which is quite an extraordinary thing. Your listeners have to remember, that these hundreds of people had never met an American before, except for Ahmad, never met a Jew before, and I happen to be Jewish. Takes my hand in friendship, and he says to me that the day of judgment will not come until every Jew is killed, saying of the prophet that he is telling me, and he is telling me that if the Jew, the prophet said, is hiding behind a rock, the rock itself will cry out, O Muslim, kill the Jew that is hiding behind me, and if the Jew is hiding behind the tree will cry out. And so at that point, I was ready for the interview to end, as you can well imagine. But while he became disillusioned with the corruption, he became more radicalized and joined an even more radical Taliban cell inside Pakistan, responsible for numerous terrorist acts. So not everybody who experiences this from the inside leaves the cause.
What were the common themes that you think social scientists and people who want to understand this, what did you find that people can take away?
Every time people read these stories, they come away with so much. I can't tell you the reaction I get, including from American intelligence officials, actually read the stories and hear these people's words and thoughts from their own point of view. It just gives you a very different perspective on what's really going on and what these people are really thinking. And there's hope. I mean, I mentioned that last story of the guy who became even more radicalized. But there's another story in the book of a guy by the name of Shahid, who was in a Taliban cell ultimately responsible for bombing the Marriott Hotel. So these guys are very hardcore. In any event, he was so struck by a dream that I had, because the importance of dreams in this and their belief system and culture is cannot be underestimated. But he was so struck that I had what he interpreted as a religious vision, that he saw me for the first time not as the hated enemy, the hated American, but as a fellow human being. And he then left the violence of the Taliban. He joined a very fundamentalist sect. But he left the violence, and he renounced the violence. So the hope here, just like Ahmad meeting the American army nurse, the hope here is tangible. I felt it. I felt it with the human bonds that I was able to make with some of these people, despite who they were. You asked a little bit about this at the beginning. But that it can be transformative if we reach out. So there's a lot of hope in these stories.
Right. You mentioned actually three. You said Shahid, Ahmad, but also Kamal. Tell us about Kamal. You said he is also hope.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Kamal was he grew up in he's part of the royal family in Saudi Arabia. More importantly, even than the royal family, he's part of the religious branch of the royal family. Who people in that country follow and have a very strict and puritanical interpretation. And, you know, I met his father who believes that, Jews are doomed and going to hell. And Kamal went through a transition, and I think we don't have the time for me to describe it, but went through a transition where he left that kind of belief to believing that heaven is available for anyone, and it's not just restricted to Muslims. And this was a remarkable transformation in a young man who grew up with the strictest and most narrow of interpretations.
The other thing about Kamal in particular from your book is that he really helped you to understand how much American policies were really fueling radicalism. What policies were the most important to Kamal and to others?
Actually, I think that he led me to see that really, as he said to me, is really not America. America sees itself as the center of everything that's happening in the world, but really the radicalism in large part is coming from within the Muslim world itself, and it's people like Kamal and to a lesser extent Ahmad and Shahid who are changing that point of view, that it really comes less from American policy and more from their own world and their own perspective and their own beliefs. So that's not American policy, of course, influences things, but not what's controlling what's going on. But it shouldn't be seen as Kamal said, it's not, America that's determining the course of everything, that a lot of this, the radicalism comes from conflicts within their own societies. The message I get is, lead by example. Don't try to impose your point of view, particularly by force of arms, on us. We admire America, but we admire America if it leads by example, not by force or not by telling us what to do. And that's the message you hear all over the world, no matter radical or not.
Ken Ballin is the author of Terrorists in Love, The Real Lives of Islamic Radicals. He is a longtime prosecutor and the president and founder of Terror Free Tomorrow, a not-for-profit organization. Thank you so much, Ken Ballin.
Did you see the frightened ones? Did you hear the falling bombs? Did you ever wonder why we had to run for shelter when the promise of a brave new world unfurled beneath the clear blue sky? Flames are all long gone, but the pain lingers on.
Hello and welcome to the Scholar's Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. After last week's electoral victory for Vladimir Putin's president, another set of large protests has filled the streets of Moscow with claims of massive fraud. One group called the League of Voters set up after last December's elections is now refusing to recognize the results of the presidential election. Russian officials have cracked down on protesters, arresting nearly 600 people. What does the latest round of elections and protests mean for Russia? What do they mean for Russia's relationship with the West and its place within the international system? We are joined by three experts. Catherine Stoner Weiss is a senior fellow at the Center on Democracy Development and the Rule of Law at Stanford University, author of Resisting the State, Reform and Retrenchment in Post-Soviet Russia. Robert English is professor of international relations and director of the School of International Relations at USC and author of Russia and the Idea of the West, Gorbachev, Intellectuals and the End of the Cold War. Daniel Treisman is professor of political science at UCLA and author of The Return of Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev. When we consider, number one, Putin's long-term position of power and revolving from office to office, and the large-scale protests, and then the fact that even if there is massive fraud, it seems Putin still won well over 50%. So is it more of the same? And are there signals that the old guard is changing? Rob English?
As you said, the results mean that Putin won. That's the first thing these elections mean. So we have the same leaders in place for a considerable period in the future. As to what change we might expect, I've always been, as a political scientist, as a Sovietologist, pretty leader-centered. And that's an understandable predilection when you deal historically with a country, autocracy, or one-party dictatorship. And in this case, what I'm simply saying is that it all depends on one man. He can't do everything he wants. Bureaucracy, corruption, there are endemic problems. But if Putin decides he's happy with the way things are going and these protests and public opinion are a threat, that he's overcome that, then status quo for the foreseeable future. If, on the other hand, cautiously optimistic that this is correct, he becomes the depths of especially urban discontent and this all-important rising middle class being so angry with him and the stagnation of Russia today, then, yes, I said, cautiously optimistic that we could see a return to the reformist Putin, to the liberal Putin. And I know that's going to surprise some listeners, but the more reformist, liberal, free market Putin that we saw his first few years in office.
Daniel Treisman?
I think we're going to see a gradual decay of the current regime, and it might end up not being so gradual. I think, for the moment, Putin is clearly back in charge, but the country is more divided than it's been in a long time. Really, it's going to be a situation of something like psychological warfare between the urban classes that are extremely disenchanted with Putin, on the one hand, and provincial Russians, who are mostly, perhaps, disgruntled about some things, but still basically supportive of Putin, at least as long as they continue to get material benefits from the state. And we need to remember that many in the provinces are highly economically dependent on the central state. So it's going to be a situation of division in which the elite is going to continue to be scathing and dismissive and to continue to protest, if not in the streets, in other ways. And I would expect Putin's popularity to continue to decline unless we see an unexpected upsurge in the growth rate. So he's going to have to deal with that much more difficult situation. It's conceivable that he would react to that by returning to the sorts of policies that we saw in the early 2000s, returning to some of those reforms. But it's much harder to do those for the second time. He would really be obliged to undo the things that he's been doing since 2003. And psychologically, that's more difficult than to introduce them the first time. So I'm not confident that he will be able to make the kind of reforms necessary to prevent continuing decay of his regime. And I think at some point, which is impossible to predict precisely, the whole thing could collapse.
Daniel Treisman, you had actually said last December, I think in an op-ed on CNN, that you thought this was the beginning of the end for Putin in December. At what point do you see it really shifting?
Well, we can't predict that. We know that his approval ratings have fallen in the last 4 years. They peaked late 2007, if I remember right, and they've gradually fallen. He's taken a big hit with the global financial crisis and its effects on Russia. With extremely generous state spending, he's managed to cushion the population to some extent. But still, it's nothing like the boom years of the early 2000s. better than his previous result in 2008 and his result in 2004, but still it looks as though, even taking away all the falsification and irregularities, it looks as though he got more than 50%. But as his popularity continues to decline, the real danger is that there will be, the real danger for him is that there will be defections within his own entourage, his own circle, and the elites that have benefited from his rule may start to wonder if he really remains the best representative for them and the best protector of them. It's often that sort of division within the incumbent elite that sets the process into high gear, accelerate a decline of an incumbent regime.
As I understand, the local elections are shifting right now. So if not the presidential change, that there is a rise in popularity on the local level and elections on the local level of the opposition. Catherine Stoner Weiss has been writing about Putin and what this means.
I would just add a few things. One is, one of the intriguing things here is that it's actually people who have benefited, well, almost the most, from Putin's rise since 2000 and who are out on the street. So it's urban middle class, which is interesting. So this sort of would seem to fit modernization theory in that the well-educated, sort of urbanized folks are the ones who rise up and demand more representation and honest elections. I think the cautionary note here, and I guess I would perhaps not go so far as to say this is the beginning of the end for Putin. I think this is the beginning of Putin needing to be more responsive than he's been historically. And that's good. That doesn't necessarily need to bring the entire regime down, though, unless he becomes so very rigid and unwilling to respond to this urbanized middle class. That's the first point. The second point is, I think we have to be a little cautious in thinking about exactly how far these protests go. A colleague from Moscow was at Stanford the other day, and he remarked on the difference between the rest of Russia and inside the Garden Ring, the highway that rings Moscow. The largest protests, of course, have taken place in Moscow. There have been some in St. Petersburg and in a few other cities. But Russia is a large country and spans 10 time zones. I think Medvedev has settled on 10 time zones now. It used to be 11. I think we're back to 10 now. And there is a heartland that is supportive of Putin, rightly or wrongly. And we have to keep those people in mind. They're not the ones necessarily who are out on the street, but they are the ones who are voting for him. And I don't at all doubt that there was widespread fraud, and certainly a lot of it's been caught on video. I think the problem is not just things like what they call carousel voting, where people move from one ballot box to one voting station to the next and vote, or even, you know, stuffing ballot boxes. It's the fact that the opposition's not allowed equal time on media to present their platforms, so they don't become a meaningful opposition as a result. Or electoral registration standards are manipulated so that other candidates can't register. He may be forced to change the system in that respect. People are definitely wising up to that. I think probably the third issue here is that while he does have this kind of staunch support in parts of the Russian heartland, as Anne mentioned, support in other places is waning. You know, he probably wouldn't have gotten 60% of the vote if it was a completely free and fair election. But I think most of us would agree he would have gotten over 50%. So he probably would have won in an out-and-out majority, although it's not a free and fair election if people are not allowed to present alternative viewpoints in the media. You know, he may be gradually nudged toward being a little more responsive. I think that's short of bringing down the entire regime. I think what we saw on Monday with protests following the election on Sunday, and the number of police out on the streets of Moscow in particular, indicates that he's a little hesitant to really let things get out of control. I mean, ultimately, he's afraid of the street. So my guess is that we'll see incremental changes over time. I think Dan and Rob are probably right in thinking that he's got to keep Russia growing. He's got to keep inflation under control. And they're going to have some important challenges coming up in terms of letting the good times roll. I think what's really distinctively in his favor, and it's nothing that Putin has done, is, you know, global oil prices are high. And as long as oil is over $100 a barrel, they're in pretty good shape in terms of the budget. I think another thing, though, he may be unwilling and unable to do this, is do something about corruption. And Russians have had enough of the corruption that they face in everyday life, be it in, you know, the healthcare system and getting treatment from a doctor at a hospital, or in the education system, or, you know, trying to get a driver's license. It's endemic, and it is a real hamper to Russia's long-term sustainable development. So that's a real weakness. If Putin ignores that for a long time, he'll become increasingly vulnerable as well.
Rob English, let me go to you, because last time you were on the air with us, we talked about the issues related to corruption, and you had indicated then that they were already gradually reforming the country in a way that was addressing these things. Can you talk about what we've seen in terms of reform so far and where you see it going?
If I gave that impression, it was probably a little too strong. In other words, there have been a number of anti-corruption campaigns launched. Certainly, current president Medvedev, prime minister, president, it is a carousel there as well, has made this a centerpiece of his intended policies. And when there have been particularly egregious scandals in certain police departments or ministries, people have been sacked, people have been prosecuted, but they haven't made any real headway. They really haven't. And, yeah, I agree with my colleagues. This is the most serious, one of the most serious sources of discontent. Certainly the savvy, educated urban elites. Maybe it's more about dignity and a political voice, but for ordinary Russians, it's corruption and bureaucracy. But on the other hand, we have to keep context. This is not the United States. This is not Sweden. Russians have had a corrupt system for centuries. This is not to say that it's not a serious problem, but just that we shouldn't expect, or they don't even demand, anything as clean or as efficient as we're used to thinking about. You know, it will remain corrupt. It will take centuries to change cultural patterns as well as sort of administrative institutional incentives. Finally, I would just add that, I would kind of split the corruption into two main problems or manifestations. One is what I just said, public discontent, anger, frustration at the degrading and tiring daily life. The second is, you know, as Catherine said, the corruption that does or doesn't affect the economy. And as long as they're exporting oil and the prices remain that high, and foreign companies are willing to come in and deal with that kind of corruption and manipulation on that level and still make a really healthy profit, then I don't see it really hurting the economy, the larger, you know, the rate of inflation, growth, and so forth in any significant way. Look at the level of FDI, foreign direct investment in Russia. It's more responsive to oil and to certain changes in law that permit this or that kind of deal. And it is to sort of the petty daily degradation and humiliation affect individuals. It doesn't stop business, and that's booming.
Daniel Treisman, I know that corruption is an area that you have studied in depth and done a comparative study of corruption, and I would like to bring you in on that. How would you place Russia's corruption in terms of a comparative sense?
Obviously, it's very difficult to measure corruption, and people, when they try to study this, often use measures of perceptions of corruption, which are based on opinion polls and so-called expert ratings. And the problem is that we don't really know to what extent those measure actual frequency of corruption or conventional wisdom and media portraits of different countries. So it's problematic. The kind of data that I think are most informative are data from opinion polls of respondents in different countries, which ask things like, have you or anyone in your family been asked or expected to pay a bribe during the last 12 months? And if we look at data on that sort of question from polls that are taken in multiple countries, Russia turns out to be not an outlier, to have something like the level of reported corruption that we would expect for a country at its income level, which is still high enough to be a major irritant to the public, but not unique by any means. So I would say corruption is a huge issue in Russia, but as in many other countries, people get most angry about corruption when the economy is bad. When the economy is booming, they may recognize that there's a great deal of corruption, but they are just less angry about it. When things slow down, then they blame the corruption much more for causing the economic problems, and they get more upset. So I think corruption is likely to be a big issue as the economy slows, The oil price is quite high at the moment. But still, I think most people expect growth to be somewhere in the range of 3 or 4% rather than higher. And the budget commitments that Putin has extended during this campaign and before that, during the financial crisis, have really increased public spending very dramatically and placed greater pressure on the budget. So these days, it's said that they need an oil price of about $130 a barrel to balance the budget. They still have a lot of money in reserve funds of different kinds, but they face serious fiscal problems, which they'll have to resolve. And this intersects with the politics, because it's been understood, or at least rumored, that the administration is going to introduce some fairly painful economic reforms after the elections. And in the current political climate, there's potential for those economic reforms, which include reforms in the pension system, perhaps even the introduction of property tax. There's a potential for those reforms to spread the discontent from the cities, perhaps further into the provinces.
Let's connect this to Russia's relationship with the West, particularly because of the energy supplies you're talking about. Catherine Stoner Weiss, can you talk about this relationship between Russia and the West and how, in fact, the latest developments might or might not impact that?
I'd also be interested in finding out from Dan where the 130, where you get the figure of $130 a barrel as being what's needed to keep the balance in budget in balance in order to meet some of the commitments that Putin has made. I'd not heard that high a number, but that is very significant, if that's correct.
Yeah. Former Finance Minister Kudrin said 120 about a year ago, and 130 has been reported in some economic reports of investment banks in Russia.
It used to be far lower than that, but it's 75 a barrel. So that's a pretty significant jump. So in terms of the relationship with the West, with oil and natural gas in particular, well, oil, Russia is, I think I did mention in my op-ed piece, Russia is the world's leading producer of oil. It's not always the world's leading exporter because it has such a large domestic demand as well. So the situation has been created that Western Europe is increasingly dependent on Russian oil. And if Iran goes ahead, and this is how all of these, you know, geopolitics are connected, if Iran goes ahead and you know, cut off Italy and a bunch of other countries. I'm not sure they've threatened to cut off Germany, but maybe they have from Iranian oil exports. Then, you know, where do the Europeans turn to make up the difference? Most likely they would turn to Russia. And Russia's already supplying a great deal of oil and natural gas, in particular, to Western Europe. So Germany is shockingly dependent, for example, Europe's largest economy, on Russia for natural gas supplies. And in the past, Russia has not been above kind of using this kind of energy dependence as a tool to thrash other former Soviet republics, or try to beat them into submission, and perhaps most notable here has been Ukraine. And, you know, that's maybe unlikely to happen right now, but certainly Germany's economy is quite vulnerable. And as we're watching with the European financial crisis that has been catching, or the contagion, I suppose, of crisis that's been spreading, this begins to affect us to some degree as well. The other issue I think to think about, too, is Russia's relations with China and its energy relations with China, which is, sort of a counterbalance, I suppose, to Western influence globally. So this is if oil prices go higher and higher and we continue to have trouble in the Middle East and trouble with Iran, Russia becomes more and more powerful and strategically important in the energy sector in particular. And in the past, we've seen it become more aggressive in terms of its more general foreign policy as oil prices go up. There's at least a correlation.
Rob English.
Can I tell a different oil story or a different energy story? Because I don't really disagree. I'm only learning from my colleagues and agreeing with them. But I think this might come back indirectly to the question of Russia and the West, Russia and the U.S. There's a company based in Irving, Texas, called Carbo Ceramics, that has a major investment, I think close to $40 million, in a joint venture in the Chelyabinsk region of the Ural Mountains, and is one of many such investments from Western companies. The business has boomed, I think, something like over $4 billion in the last couple of years. This company, Carbo Ceramics, make proppants. You might not know what proppants are, but you've probably heard of hydrofracking, this technology that's producing so much more natural gas in Texas and the Marcellus Shale and in Pennsylvania, upstate New York, and so forth, and the controversy it's involved. Fracking is when a vertical well, and then turned horizontal with advanced technology, is able to open up the shale deposits, which are very impermeable. It's hard to get that stuff to flow. They inject water, steam, under incredibly high pressures, which opens up all these cracks. But then as soon as you take the water out, the cracks close, unless you inject also tiny ceramic beads called proppants, right? They prop open the strata and allow this oil, this gas, to come out. Carbo Ceramics is one of the world's, maybe the world's biggest, or one of the biggest producers, now in a joint venture with Russia. And I just thought how interesting that this product produced in the Ural Mountains in a joint venture between Russian and American firms is crucial to the United States' vast expansion, potentially really vast expansion of domestic natural gas production, mostly in the eastern United States. Haven't thought through the implications of that. Maybe you could just use this as a case of one of the manifestations of globalization. Of course, it just draws attention back to other parts of the Russian economy. I'd like to note for listeners that for all of the importance and the growth, the importance of petroleum exports to Russia's budget, to its growth in recent years, all the rest, in fact, depending on how you measure the statistics and adjust for inflation and prices, manufacturing, right, grew even more over the 2000s. It accounts for a larger share of GDP than it did before. And so here's one small example, and there's others in food processing and textiles and on and on. Now, I'm not saying that Russia is weaning itself from its on export oil and gas, nothing like that. But there is another part of the economy, and there are encouraging signs, quite apart from the politics and protests on the streets of to urban centers.
And the one piece we haven't really addressed yet, and I'm going to toss this to Daniel Treisman, is Russia's engagement with the Middle East, particularly with the uprisings that are going on, and its support for, say, Syria. Daniel Treisman, you've actually been writing about this, and this also folds into the relationship between Russia and the West. How do you see this?
Right. Well, I think, Russia is not going to cooperate with the West in the Middle East or anywhere else just because the West asks it to. There has to be a two-way relationship. I think the Obama administration has been quite pragmatic and realistic about this and has realized that there are certain issues on which Russia and the U.S. Have common interests, but there are many on which their views diverge, and one can insult the Russians for refusing to sign on to the UN Security Council resolution over Syria, but that's not going to make them more likely to do so in the future. The policymakers in the Kremlin look at what has happened in the Middle East in recent years, and they see the U.S. and NATO intervening militarily in Afghanistan, in Iraq, then in Libya, pressure from the West to dislodge Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. And they see, perhaps cynically, a program of expanding U.S. influence into areas near them. And so they are concerned about that. They are nervous about that continuing, and at the same time, they're concerned about instability in the Middle East and in Central Asia, which could affect geopolitics to their south and could end up inflaming regions which are important to their security, namely Central Asia and the Caucasus. They have a different view of this, and I think basically on Syria, the Russians were just waiting to see what would happen if they thought that Assad was on his last legs. Then they would desert him and come over to the West and try to get on the good side of the next regime, quickly and cynically, they decided to wait that out to see what would happen and to remain in good relations with him until that situation clarified. And so I think they have a sort of cynical view, a realistic view of the Middle East, and they're very unconvinced that Western policy in the Middle East is as humanitarian and motivated by desire to see everybody living in freedom as it's sometimes portrayed to be.
Wow. Well, I hate to end on that negative note, but we're out of time. So I'm going to have to thank the three of you here. Catherine Stoner Weiss, Senior Fellow at the Center on Democracy Development and the Rule of Law at Stanford University, author of Resisting the State, Reform and Retrenchment in Post-Soviet Russia. Robert English, Professor of International Relations and Director of the School of International Relations at USC, and author of Russia and the Idea of the West, Gorbachev, Intellectuals and the End of the Cold War. Daniel Treisman, Professor of Political Science at UCLA and author of The Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That is it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to our guest producer, Kate Sviatets, Ankina Agassian, our co-producer, and assistant producer, Ishmael Karim. Extra special thanks to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can catch it on the audio archives at kpfk.org, or you can keep up with us at armudian.com or scholarcircle.org, and you can follow me at Armudian on Twitter. We'll see you next week.